Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In communities across New Hampshire, there's growing concern about the toll of daily stress on local first responders, police, firefighters, and emergency personnel. Research indicates post-traumatic stress disorder is prevalent in these professions, and one often cited study finds first responders have a 20% higher suicide rate than the general public. Because of this, there is more attention nowadays on helping this population cope with the job's psychological challenges. However, that too can be difficult in careers where being physically and emotionally tough is considered a requirement. Some don't want to admit to anything that looks like weakness. Today in The Exchange, the mental health of our first responders. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call 1-800-892-6477. We have four guests in studio with us is Dr. Nicole Sawyer, licensed clinical psychologist, vice chair of the New Hampshire Legislative Commission on PTSD and TBI. She works primarily with survivors of trauma, specifically combat veterans, law enforcement, firefighters, EMS. She's also supporting psychologist for the New Hampshire State Police Peer Support Unit. Dr. Sawyer, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us, Chief David Goldstein. He's chief of police in Franklin. He's been on the Franklin force for 10 years. Chief Goldstein, thank you for being here very much.
Thank you.
Also with us, Todd Donovan, firefighter and paramedic for the Derry Fire Department, data specialist for the Division of Fire Standards and Training and Emergency Medical Services. Todd shares his own experience with mental illness with other first responders to help spread awareness about treatment and prevent suicide. And Todd, a big welcome back. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us, retired Major Russell Conti, former major in New Hampshire State Police. Today he works in peer counseling and behavioral health. He's co-chair of the state's Suicide Prevention Council. And Major Conti, it's really good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Major Conti, I want to start with you. Why is this issue of PTSD in first responders getting so much attention now? Because I'm guessing the issue itself is not new.
No, the issue's not new. The issue's been around as long as first responders have been around and as long as, you know, these professions have been out interacting with the public in crisis. I think that the change that's been made is that we have taken, you know, a little more time to look at ourselves and start to heal ourselves. And that's something really that, you know, aside from the last decade, didn't happen very often. And because of that, you know, there's a lot of first responders that I had worked with and, you know, in my last 33 years that, you know, that were casualties, you know, of their profession that didn't get the help that they needed. So I think, you know, with the advent of the people that my colleagues here in the studio today and a lot of other people that are working hard, you know, we're starting to take those steps and starting to make sure that we, you know, we look at the profession as something that that is taxing and that does change you. And then we also work to make sure that these professionals that are so highly trained and so committed to service can make a good, solid career, develop the coping skills they need to deal with what they see and what they have to do activity-wise, and come through it and be, you know, just productive, not only as professionals, but, you know, productive in the rest of their lives. And I think it's something that just gets a lot more attention for all the right reasons.
It's really interesting to hear you say around in the last 10 years or so, we started looking at ourselves. What was the sort of pivot point or pivot points or reasons where people in your profession said, we really need to start examining this?
Well, I think there's, you know, I talk about casualties on the job, and it doesn't mean that someone has to lose their lives because, unfortunately, every year for first responders, and I could talk, you know, law enforcement alone, the number of law enforcement officers that die by suicide far eclipses the number that are, you know, die in line of duty deaths. It's something that was not shared. We looked at it differently. We didn't take the time to really look at what the causes were and what we could do, you know, to combat those problems. So, you know, when we started looking at ourselves, we started to learn that, you know, in healing some of what we have for our own exposure, we provide better service and we become better first responders. And we're able to not only interact better professionally with ourselves, but certainly with the public that we serve. So I think there's everybody in this room can share certainly stories of what they've seen. And I certainly have friends and colleagues that I work with that didn't come through the profession very well. And the other thing is you won't find anybody in law enforcement that hasn't lost somebody, you know, to suicide or to substance abuse or all the things that can happen when these kind of stresses overtake your life and the, you know, the professional part of you goes headlong into the personal part of you. So I think it was high time for us all to look at it, but it's not easy. And I mean, we're lucky, you know, today to be in the studio with Chief Golston, who started many, many years ago. He worked for state police prior to being the chief of Franklin. And these were things that were budding many years ago, but only really have taken a hold. And people have really realized, and it's been, you know, tragedies, unfortunately, that have forced us and things that we've seen. So it's really a commitment of those people still in the profession, those people that are lucky enough to give back like myself after, you know, a great career and a continuing career. And I think that's what's making all the difference.
Dr. Sawyer, it is shocking to hear Major Conti say that more law enforcement officers die by suicide than in the line of duty. An often cited study by the Rudderman Foundation says first responders have a 20% higher suicide rate than the general population. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's not particularly surprising because this is an incredibly resilient population. These are incredibly resilient folks. So when they are having difficulties, the difficulties are usually very long and slow to develop because they are problem solvers. So as they're having difficulties, these small difficulties that happen day to day, they're solving those little problems here and there, but those little problems begin to build up. And over time, it exceeds the capacity of their ability to cope. And if there's no opportunity to ask for help, if asking for help is not embraced, if it's not supported, if weakness is the word that comes to their mind when they feel like they need help, then the concept of suicide or the option of suicide becomes more prevalent.
So PTSD doesn't develop according to what most people think. There's one big traumatic thing that happens. You witness a death or you're in a war. It's almost death by a thousand cuts, Dr. Sawyer.
Absolutely. There, now, certainly there are situations where people encounter one particular event that
sure.
is that absolutely overwhelms their capacity. But for this population in particular, typically it is. It's like a thousand cuts. It is the day in and day out difficulties that they face. They face people on their worst days at their worst times over and over and over again. And they're encountering children and the elderly and it in situations that sort of claw away at your soul. And so folks are dealing with this on a daily basis and trying to figure out how to go home to their families at night and look at their own children that they're tucking into bed. So the trauma is more cumulative. PTSD was designed around a concept, the diagnosis of PTSD was designed around a concept of this massive tragic event that you feared for your life or someone else's life. There's a whole diagnosis around it. But the reality is for folks in the first responder community that it is a slow chipping away and not typically one big catastrophic event.
And that has implications down the line for treatment, for services, and so forth, when we have to sort of redefine the event that caused the PTSD. So we'll talk about that for sure.
Absolutely.
A little bit later. But Todd, I did want to turn to you. What's your own experience as a firefighter with this issue of suicide and depression?
Well, I have a diagnosis of major depression, and I was diagnosed with that at the age of 18 after several suicide attempts. And I go around and I talk to a lot of first responders about how treatment works, because I did find a treatment that worked about 4 years ago. For me as a firefighter and paramedic, I have a psychologist that I work with, and she brought up an interesting point that I chose this profession to keep myself close to death, which was an interesting concept that I never really thought about. But, you know, as a firefighter paramedic, I see things, I hear things, and our telecommunicators, our dispatchers, they hear things too. I touch things, I feel things, I smell things that are unnatural on a daily basis. Some days are worse than others, and it does build up over time. And I want people to know that that treatment does work. There are people like Dr. Sawyer who spend a lifetime studying this and providing treatment for people like me.
You go out, Todd, to other first responder groups. You talk about your own experience. You talk about your attempts at suicide. What's the response that you get?
People are pretty surprised. I know a lot of people in the state. I hid my depression very, very well. I was a master at it. The only people that really knew about my depression were my family. And they didn't know how to deal with it either. There wasn't a lot of support. Now we're trying to change that. We're trying to, it's not really stigma, as Ken Norton of NAMI says. It's really discrimination. It's got to change. We've got to let first responders know and our telecommunicators know that treatment does work. And it's a lot safer and easier to nip this in the bud early in your career than later in your career. So that's what I try to tell people.
How can managers, supervisors of firefighters like you nip it in the bud when, as you just told us, you were really good at putting on a happy face?
There were signs that I put out. I had a department physical, and the physician completely ignored my cry for help. I said, I don't think I'm going to survive. And he just let it slide.
Wow, and that seems pretty obvious.
Yeah, and he moved on. And I was really kicking myself because I did not want anyone to know. And in a moment of weakness, I let that slip out. Now, he should have chalked that door open and explored that more. But as for first-line supervisors, there were subtle signs. I would sleep a lot. I would be withdrawn. There were subtle signs that I let out, but I wasn't screaming, hey, I'm in pain. I need help.
It's interesting that you chose that word, in a moment of weakness. I let it slip out. That's part of the problem, isn't it, Todd?
It's admitting. Very tough to say that there's a problem. But when I speak to first responders, I can't tell you how many people come out of the woodwork and tell me their story. And usually it's the first time that they've ever told me their story or told their story to anybody. So I find, I know that, you know, 1 in 5 people are suffering from a mental illness. We can count, you know, in the groups that I speak of, there's probably 5 or 6 people in there that struggle with a mental illness and never really told their story.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, we're exploring post-traumatic stress disorder, how it affects New Hampshire's first responders, police, firefighters, emergency personnel. We'd love your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email exchange@nhpr.org. Chief Goldstein, what struggles do you see with your own police force in Franklin?
Franklin's no different than any other police department. Just because we're smaller doesn't mean we're any different than, let's say, a Manchester or a Nashua or a Derry or a Londonderry. The struggles that we see are the same. We have to respond to these incidents. You can come out of the academy, be brand new on the force, and on your first day of work, you could be in the middle of something that you never expected, even though it was discussed at the academy. That, and to Dr. Sawyer's point as well, the day-to-day stresses and strains that go along with police work. So we have to be cognizant of that, and we've been looking at this, frankly, for the last 40 or 50 years, we've been trying to deal with this. Now, in the old days, if you will, in the 70s and the 60s, it was all substance abuse related, something that we're very familiar with today, but not necessarily drugs, but alcohol. And police officers were very, very well known for being alcoholics on the job until such time as it became necessary to intervene. And in those days, the chief of police would sit in his desk and call in the individual who was having a problem and offer them 2 pieces of paper. This is your entrance into AA, or your agreement to go to AA, and this is your resignation. Which do you want to sign? And interestingly enough, a lot of the officers that came back from AA were better police officers. But the stigma and the prejudice, if you will, still remained with us for all these decades until recently. And it took a lot of work from a lot of different individuals to make it work that way. We have policies and procedures now that we can access. We have teams that we can use in order to intervene when necessary. We have individuals like Dr. Sawyer, which is an incredible comfort to be able to know I can pick up the telephone and say, I have an officer in trouble. Can you help? So all of this plays a role in what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Your story about how it was in the 60s and 70s, an officer is drinking heavily. You, as his commanding officer, call him in and say, you know, here's your resignation papers or here's your application to go to AA. It's interesting to me that there isn't a third piece of paper. By the way, here's a counselor who you can go to for help to talk about this.
There was no such thing. And in fact, again, using the term the old days, when I was doing work, peer support with police officers, it was like doing a drug deal. We would meet at night. We would meet in plain clothes. We would meet at, I used to be able to say, into every Dunkin' Donuts south of the Notch, but with drive-thrus, that's changed. But we would meet at Dunkin' Donuts, and for the next couple, 3 hours, we would sit and talk about some of these issues. And we had a very small, intimate, and hidden group of individuals that could help. Again, akin to Dr. Sawyer's role today. So there were clinicians that I could call in a secretive manner and say, I have a police officer. The labels that were put on us in those days were horrific because we were expected to be able to do all of this without any problem whatsoever.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org. Before we go to our listeners, Chief Goldstein, one more question for you. It's so interesting to me to hear Todd say, again, I put on a very happy face. No one would have known. Maybe little warning signs here and there, but none that really went on people's radar. What do you look for among your officers to know that they might be having a hard time?
There are a slew of symptoms that we can look for. Some are hidden, as Todd said. Some are very, very blatant and right in your face, if you will. The point there, however, is not so much that, as important as that is, but it's the reception. If someone's not willing to receive, as Todd mentioned, his physician, if someone's not willing to receive that message, then it means nothing. So we look for that actively now, and it becomes very, very apparent. If you have a high-producing officer, someone that's out there all the time, and all of a sudden he or she just isn't involved anymore, isn't interested anymore, that's a signpost.
Disengagement.
Exactly.
What other signs do you look for, Major Conti?
I think disengagement's important. I think, problems, just disciplinary problems, which we used to just look at as strictly discipline. And this is somebody that's either, you know, having problems at home, is getting themselves in policy problems, on the job, on duty, off duty. And I think now we're much more apt to look to see if there's an issue that's underlying instead of just, laying discipline out, having the person even go deeper. And, and this is where our ability, as an organization that had the first peer counseling unit to be able to interact, and we are a referral service, and we look to people like Dr. Sawyer, to get people where they need to be. And I think what you find is if you can reach people at those times when they're having a problem and get them to the help that they need, they come through it much better. The organization is healthier. The attitudes, the spirit of the organization is better because everybody watches when somebody's having a problem. They may not know what the problem is or the basis behind it, but they do see how an organization treats people. And, everybody goes through the same things as first responders, and it's how they can come through it and the skills that they learn. And I think that support really does change the organizations and the spirit of what services.
We'll talk a lot more after a short break and start taking your calls and emails. Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. More on New Hampshire's first responders and post-traumatic stress disorder in just a moment. Stay with us.
Thank you.
I'm Jason Moon, host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR. Join me for a live show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on Tuesday, May 14th. I'll speak about how we produced Bear Brook, the controversial science that helped crack open the case, and how that science is changing criminal investigations all across the country. Get your tickets now at thewilbur.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, post-traumatic stress disorder and how it affects New Hampshire's first responders, police, firefighters, emergency personnel. We're also talking about ongoing efforts to better understand this and better take care of it. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call 1-800-892-6477. By the way, as we mentioned earlier, suicide rates among this population of first responders. If you or someone you care about is in crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Again, 1-800-273-TALK. We have more information on our website today, nhpr.org/exchange. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Michael says, as someone who has served in a profession that also deals with PTSD, how do you balance the desire to help the afflicted individual and also deal with the impact to the organization's performance and the other individuals in the organization? Michael says, I have paid a personal price when an organization failed to separate an individual whose PTSD-related behavior led to workplace violence. What programs exist for treatment after separation? Wow, Michael, I'm sorry to hear that that happened to you. And Chief Goldstein, I'm going to turn to you first, but anybody can jump in. Go ahead.
That is a very complicated question because, again, we're still trying to find our way through all of the various aspects of PTSD and its sequelae. So we have to be very aware of what's going on around us. It's that simple. If we don't react to someone whom we think is suffering from this disorder, then shame on us, quite frankly, and shame on my colleagues who have the ability to intervene. But to be able to put a quick point on it is very, very difficult. I certainly feel for the individual, for the emailer who experienced this. And at the same time, I wonder what was going on in that particular profession that he mentioned.
Well, it kind of gets to what Major Conti said earlier, and I'll turn to you, Dr. Sawyer, the idea that it isn't just about the individual. It isn't just about providing better service to the community as a firefighter or police officer, but it's also about everybody else who's, you know, it's already a difficult job. And then you have someone whose post-traumatic stress symptoms are not being treated, and it just brings the whole organization down.
Absolutely. One of the difficulties, I think, is that we are very quick to turn and pass the buck on to whose responsibility it is to take care of these folks. You know, it's great that we have more and more command staff now who are encouraging their officers and their firefighters and their EMS personnel to get help. But I will tell you that the town budgets are not often supporting the command staff in doing so. excuse me. Town budgets are not prepared right now to pay for professional debriefings after critical events. They're not prepared to pay for better screening tools for hiring. So the onus really comes down to the state legislative level, to the town budgeting level, and then down to the command staff, who is then able to provide the resources that these officers need in order to get well and stay well.
Tom, what do you think about that? You're operating, again, in a town budget, and resources are often limited at the town level. What might help firefighters manage with this so that it doesn't reach a situation that our emailer Michael talks about?
Well, one of the things we're doing at the Derry Fire Department is we're creating a peer support program. Interestingly enough, I'm the only member of the peer support program at Derry, so hence I'm the team leader. and we're going to start that process now, and that is the sort of the first line defense to combat this problem. And it really, the peer support program is essentially a place for people to vent and for me to refer if necessary. And we're going to be working with local psychologists that want to work with the Derry Fire Department. We're going to be discussing that in the future so that we can refer someone quickly if they need help And they open up and they need help.
You know, Todd, it's interesting. Just before the break, Chief Goldstein talked about in the old days, late night meetings at Dunkin' Donuts with officers who might be struggling. When people come to you in that role of peer support leader, do they come to you kind of on the sly or do they openly walk into your door and say, Todd, help me out?
A little bit of both. It is on the sly for most people. They don't
Still.
Want anyone to know. And I make it really clear for this peer support program that I don't take notes. I don't have statistics. All I do is listen. And if necessary, I will refer you to the proper personnel to help you with your problem. But most of the people that I talk to don't want anyone to know. Even though that I've come out in my own fire department and have said, here's what my problem is. And the treatment that I received changed me so quickly and so radically, and it saved my life. Even though they know that, they're still very hesitant to come out and talk about it.
Major Conti, how does this narrower definition of PTSD that Dr. Sawyer described earlier, typically it's thought of as, you know, something that happens to you after one single traumatic incident, as you all have described, for first responders anyway, it's incident after incident after incident. So, but how does this narrower definition affect the way that help is given or is not given to this population?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think the way it affects it is, first off, we have a realization of it much better than we did before. We threw the term out before not really knowing what it was. We were not interacting with professionals like we should have. We did not have the referral process that we needed. So we were using people that knew or that may have been clinicians, but they didn't have an attachment to the organization. So when we started a peer counseling unit, we were very careful to make sure that we had those things in place, that we selected the peer counselors very carefully, and the confidentiality was very high. And that's been brought up several times during this discussion. But I think, you know, that's what made all the difference. It's not that it has to be a broad or a narrow description of what's happening. It can be discipline. It could be people. But the real basis for the success with peer counseling and the success in changing attitudes and healing organizations is trust and confidentiality. And I think it's been described in a lot of different ways here today. But for people to know that they can come and talk to somebody and they're not going to be judged, they're going to get better, and their job is not on the line as much as, you know, I'm going to develop these skills. And you know, many of these people, you would never know. You know, we certainly, you know, we do that. There is no notes taken. There's no statistics taken that are kept. But in the end, it's just that people know they can come and they can go somewhere for help, and it is confidential.
Chief Goldstein?
Yeah, I just want to pick up on a couple of points that came up. And I think one of them, importantly, is a definitional issue. Day-to-day stress, when we talk about peer support and peer counseling and what have you, day-to-day stress is something we all experience, irrespective of what your job or your role is in society. If you, for example, Laura, had planned or had a program that you planned on and your guest didn't show up, that's stressful. That is not necessarily a traumatic event, however.
No.
So when we talk about PTSD, and it's very close related cousin acute stress disorder, when we talk about these, we're talking about some of what you've mentioned, as Dr. Sawyer said, over time, trauma after trauma after trauma, or that one big one, or a few, what have you. But we also have a way of dealing with this. And in addition to the state police team, there are a number of teams that are out there to try to render help. And as Derry Fire's learning, there are two very active teams that will go statewide. There's the Southern New Hampshire team, which is basically housed or essentially housed at the Manchester Police Department, that will go statewide. We're all trained. We're all ICISF, International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, certified, if you will. And then there's the Granite State team, which deals with fire, police, and EMS. And these are teams that can come out and start to deal in a group process with what's going on. And then, if necessary, certainly make it known that there are referrals to other agencies and other individuals if necessary. Plus, one other thing, if you don't mind, is in 2013, we do now have statutory confidentiality for such teams. In other words, a chief can't call me up and say, gee, Dave, what did my officer say to you? And my answer to him is, well, I'm old, I forget. But other than that, in reality, the answer is none of your business.
That's interesting. Okay.
So we do have that protection as well.
You know, in terms of checking the boxes for compensation, for coverage, for time off for mental health visits, for time off just to rest and recover, How does this narrow definition, Dr. Sawyer, of PTSD play into checking the boxes so that first responders can get the help they need?
Well, currently it does present a challenge, filling out workman's comp forms, filling out forms for FMLA.
Family Medical Leave Act.
Correct. Those forms are designed around a physical injury. So they're even falling short of a mental health challenge to begin with. But many of those forms require a date of injury. Those forms require projected recovery dates, things that really are not tangible when we're talking about mental health challenges. So if you're talking about an acute stress disorder, if you're talking about full-on post-traumatic stress disorder, it's very difficult to label a date of onset, and it's very difficult to project how long the person may be out of work, how much treatment they're going to require, whether or not they're going to be capable of light duty, at what time are they going to be capable of light duty. I mean, these are all things that can be projected when you're talking about knee surgery or a broken ankle, but these are not relevant to any sort of mental health challenge.
It's interesting. We did a whole show last week on mental health parity, and when it comes to PTSD among first responders, it seems like you're saying, Dr. Sawyer, that these forms just don't fit, you know, date of injury, cumulative over the past 10 years,
correct,
expected recovery time, we're not sure, mm-hmm, lots of visits for someone to see a mental health professional. Are those covered if you haven't checked the boxes in the right way? So that seems confining.
Absolutely. More often than not, the initial application for compensation for PTSD or acute stress gets rejected. And oftentimes we have to sort of go back through and figure out how we can better submit the form to meet the demands of the party that's reviewing it and deciding whether or not this person's going to get support.
So is there legislation at the state level, local levels, to make this a little bit more manageable? Go ahead, Major Conti.
Yes, the answer to that is yes. There's a legislative committee that was convened last year, last session, and myself and Chief Goldstein were on to look at post-traumatic stress as it relates to workman's comp issues. And that has a lot to do with what Dr. Sawyer said. Part of the problem is if you're suffering from these issues, you're suffering from post-traumatic stress, from job-related things, and you're seeking help, and you put in your FMLA paperwork, you put in workman's comp paperwork, and it gets denied. That doesn't really help you out as a person.
And it was already an effort for,
yep,
you to get to that space where you could say, yes, I have a problem. Yes, right, I'm going to seek help.
So what ends up happening is many times the reason that that happens, and we explored it in this commission, is because there's a 30-day window that has to be met. And many times there isn't the information gained through therapy that's enough to put down to justify that, you know, workman's comp, that, you know, the positive aspect of making sure that you deliver, you know, a service to that person. So, you know, that's something that we looked at closely, and that happens. But that's very devastating to individuals that go through this, and that I've known personally that ask for help. So it's just one more thing that they have to be walked through. There has to be a liaison. There has to be somebody there. And that's the beauty part of what we're talking about today with these peer counseling units. And now, you know, what we have for not only state statute, but, you know, that we have for policy department-wide to help people through those times. Because if not, you are going to feel like a person without a country. You're going to feel like, I finally came out. I'm having a problem. You said you were going to help me. And now look, my job's in jeopardy. I can't pay my mortgage. I have children. So it's all the things that get in the way. So there's a lot of pieces to this to really make it go smoothly and make people have a lot of trust in, you know, in getting the help that they need. And it's a work in progress. And everybody here at this table is committed.
But if a firefighter had broken his or her leg running into a burning building, no problem.
There you go.
Let's go back to our listeners. Loretta sends an email. She says, I'm a psychologist in New Hampshire that has created a first responder resilience program. Loretta says, we can implement this in academies, departments, and local communities. Loretta says it is holistic, prevention and remediation focused, and ready to deploy. Loretta, thank you. Ian sent us an email. He says, thank you so much for doing a show on this important topic. Ian says, I'm a research assistant at SNHU working on a project focusing specifically on the stigma behind suicidality in firefighters and why they are hesitant to seek treatment. To give you an idea of the numbers, previous conservative estimates have found that 46% of firefighters have reported some sort of suicidal ideation compared to 13% of the population. This is a huge disparity, he says, and it needs to be addressed further. Ian goes on to say every single first responder I've talked to has a story about someone they know who experiences mental health issues or has committed suicide. Since we started collecting data from area first responder organizations, I've seen so much support from fire and police chiefs in working toward improving outcomes. Most truly care about their membership, and I'm humbled by their commitment to addressing this important issue. Ian, thank you so much for sharing some of your research with us. How do those numbers strike you, Todd?
It doesn't surprise me. Just from talking with people in my own department, that this is prevalent. And if I can say one thing about post-traumatic stress injury is that when you see something or hear something or smell something or touch something that's unnatural, it's like a bruise to the neurons that house that memory. And have you ever had a bruise on your arm or your leg and you constantly massage it as if it's going to get any better when you massage it? Well, it's the same thing you do with a post-traumatic stress injury. You go back and you get to massage that over and over and over in the privacy of your own mind. And no one knows that you're doing that. So I think it's important for people to understand that it really truly is an injury. It physically changes the brain.
And you keep returning to that scene, that accident scene, perhaps, because you said that you are also
an EMT. Or a smell brings it back. Or, you know, something I've touched things that are unnatural that I don't even want to get into. So you might touch Jell-O, for instance, and it'll bring back a memory. And you'll go back and massage that over and over and over again. And that's the problem that we deal with.
Do you ever think, Todd, about getting out of this field, given what you've gone through and given the very stressful situations that you tell us you continue to face? Have you ever thought, you know, I'm done with this firefighter and paramedic thing?
Well, it's all I've known for years and years. I've been a paramedic for 26 years. And I've been in the fire service for nearly 18. So it's really all I know. I have dabbled in practice, physician practice management before. It wasn't something that I really enjoy. I truly enjoy helping people. My goal now is to get into administration and to get off the front line service. So yes, it is something that I've thought about, and I'm actively doing that now. So.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Sawyer, about the front end of this. It seems to me there's more attention now, not just being paid to people in the field who are struggling with talking to their supervisors about some of the issues that they're having, but also up front at the police academy, at the firefighter training institutes, checking people out. Are they well suited for this profession? I wonder what you see going on in terms of those efforts.
Well, I think there are a couple of issues, and I've mentioned already the budgetary issues that we would love to see a more extensive self-care, coping strategy, resilience training in the academy, but there has to be the time and funding for that. We would love to see more police departments who are able to access more thorough pre-hire evaluations for their officers and for their fire EMS personnel, but there has to be room in the budget for that. I have departments that I work with in varying capacities who have to do mail-away pre-hire evaluations where the individual fills out a form, sends it in, and somebody stamps it for them far, far away. And they say to me, boy, we would love to be able to have somebody interview and really get to know this person for us and let us know their fitness, but we can't afford that. Our budget won't support it. So there are lots of factors that have to come from the top down. State legislation has to put pressure on towns. Towns have to put room in the budget so that command staff can make the best possible choices for their departments.
We'll talk about that a little bit more after a short break and keep taking your emails and calls, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Recently on The Exchange, we explored a particularly New Hampshire institution.
A town minus its general store has a huge hole in it, and people know that. Even if you don't stop at the general store, you want there to be one. because you know that that's like having the lights on. It's the pilot light of your town. And if it's out, you feel like there's something wrong.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Every weekday at 9 a.m., only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, prospects for offshore wind in New Hampshire and northern New England. We'll find out more tomorrow in The Exchange. Be sure to join us for that live at 9. Today, we're looking at the causes and impacts of PTSD among New Hampshire's first responders, firefighters, police, emergency personnel, and we're hearing from you, your questions and your stories. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Chief Goldstein, just before the break, Dr. Sawyer talked about limited budgets at the state level, at the local level. How does that affect your ability to do the best that you can to help the officers you already have and hire the best officers for the city of Franklin?
Again, that's a very multifaceted question, and the money just is not there. So quite frankly, we do the best we can with what we have. The Academy, the Police Standards and Training Council has dictated how we can go about hiring individuals, the necessity of using psychological exams, paper and pencil tests, if you will, polygraphs, backgrounds, et cetera. But I did want to follow up on one thing that the doctor said that I think is very poignant. And I'm going to use an example. Being an old polygraph examiner, we always use examples. And I know Major Conti can identify with this. We did a, by the way, the services that that officers, firefighters, and EMS folks are able to access in the state are pretty much volunteer. We do it for nothing. So when we're going out at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's pretty much on our own dime, if you will, with the blessings of our police departments and so on. However, there was one story that I think is one of the most poignant examples I've ever heard in my 40 years in doing this. And that is, I won't violate any confidences, obviously, but a small town in Rockingham County had a very traumatic incident that their one police officer had to respond to and do everything that was necessary in order to bring the situation under control, and then call in the services necessary, including major crime from state police, the medical examiner's office, and everything else. And then during the debriefing, the officer made a comment that has stayed with me since that time. He said, after he turned everything over to the necessary agencies, he said, and then I went back on patrol.
Wow. No chance to decompress or process.
Not even close. And we do that every minute of every day. So people don't realize that your firefighters, your police officers, your EMTs slash paramedics go back on patrol when it's after they've done what they needed to do. There's no downtime for us, for all intents and purposes. And that takes its toll as well.
How do the local or state policies or department-by-department policies, Chief Goldstein, manage that, deal with that? Why don't they say to that solo officer, you need to go home now?
In most cases, it's because of person power issues or a lack of understanding of what's going on. And in some cases, it happens, but usually that's very, very specific. For example, in an officer-involved shooting case, certainly the individual is taken off the line, put on administrative leave with pay, et cetera, sent to the emergency room to make sure he or she's okay and what have you. But there are a lot more critical incidents that we experience virtually on a daily basis that we don't have that opportunity for because we can't.
Well, and you're getting to a subject that we should talk about, workforce shortages in New Hampshire. As you all know, there's workforce shortages in all sorts of professions, including the professions that you all work in. And I wonder, maybe you, Todd, first, how is New Hampshire's workforce shortage in general affecting fire departments like Derry's?
It's a challenge to find, you know, good quality people. It's the pool is shrinking. We do a pretty thorough background investigation on people. We don't do a lot of psychological testing, but it's tempting not to do all those things when the pool is so dried up.
So you just say, I hope this person's going to work out. Sure.
Absolutely.
Let's go ahead and hire. And yes, it also, Major Conti, plays in when you have a situation like the one Chief Goldstein described, where someone has been through a traumatic incident, and then, as he said, they go back on patrol because there's nobody else to back them up.
Yeah, that's a problem for a lot of agencies. It's also a problem for supervision that doesn't recognize, you know, We're certainly, apart from a good, robust peer program, we're also training staff and supervisors and leaders. And, you know, how do you recognize that? How do you take steps? Because many times, if it doesn't impact the supervisor, they don't realize it, that that could happen. And it's not just a personnel issue. It could happen in agencies, large or small. So it's really a recognition that something may happen, that people need help. And let's do what we can to make sure that the rest of the shift for this person is successful. They may need some time. They may need to talk to somebody. So we've established it well enough where we get those calls. And the peer counselors get those calls and they're able to intervene. But it's a huge problem, and those are really tragic circumstances because that is something that first responder will carry with them for the rest of their lives. You know, they will talk about those things.
Or even just for the rest of that shift that day. They might react inappropriately to a situation, and people may say, well, how could that police officer act that way? But
absolutely.
That's why.
You know, when you really look close at those things and you look close, like I said, incidences that involve, you know, those precursors for post-traumatic stress, you answer a lot of questions. And I think that's more what's happened in these last few years is we're able to get answers to things. I think, you know, we kind of wondered about, we may have treated in a different, realm where we may not have given it the attention that it needed.
Well, Steve sent us an email. He wants to know if the state's geography, including small towns, and the fact that you might be responding to a call that involves someone you know has an impact on trauma. Steve asks, is it different from a first responder in a large city where they are less likely to encounter anyone they know? Chief Goldstein, do you want to jump on that? You work in a small city.
That's a very large problem. In fact, most of the services we try to provide are in the more metropolitan, if you will, areas, in the more populated areas. We have a great deal of difficulty getting help up to the north and out to the west. It's starting to change a little bit, but that is a very, very large issue. And one of the recognized critical incidents that we can undergo is just that, knowing the individuals. So my officers may very well know the individuals that they're dealing with during some of these situations, certainly.
Steve, thank you for the note. And Margaret sent us an email. She says, has any of your panel studied how public safety might be affected if personnel do not seek and receive the help they need with regards to traumatic stress? Margaret says, as a taxpayer, I would be willing to see a part of my town budget be diverted to programs to determine eligibility and or treatment. And Margaret, thank you so much for the email. And Dr. Sawyer, we talked about this earlier.
Right. You know, we all experience, as Chief Goldstein mentioned, we all experience stress every day with things. And how many of you have ever had a difficult day at work and came home and inappropriately snapped at your kid about something really minor? And it wasn't really about what the kid did, but it's about everything that built up over the day, right? Well, these police officers and these firefighters and these paramedics, they're human beings too. So if they're experiencing overwhelming, unmanaged stress throughout the day, it is possible that despite their professionalism, they're going to have a moment where they snap a little bit excessively at a citizen about something major or minor. And then that citizen complains, rightfully so. But all it does is create this cyclical event of the officer feeling like a failure. They're getting reprimanded about something that happened that really shouldn't have happened, but maybe it was just an overwhelming experience from whatever they were dealing with that morning. These are human beings too. But if we're not taking the time and providing the resources to help these folks manage their experiences every single day, make them feel confident going home and being a good father and a good mother and a good brother or sister, if we're not helping these folks feel like they can get through their careers strong and healthy, then we're putting undue stress on them as human beings.
Let's take a call, and this is Eric in Nashua. Eric, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good.
I've been listening to the show this morning, and I'm a 50-year law enforcement family member, and I just haven't heard anything today that is dealing with any kind of secondhand exposures to the families that are being subjected. And if it's about trust and trust in law enforcement, then these families have gone 20, 30 years with domestic violence rates of 40% and higher, and I don't see any services for the families, and they're the pressure relief valve for the communities and everybody else. If family members are dealing with law enforcement and firefighters and stuff, they need to be supported by the community to make sure that those families stay on track, and I would like to see a bill of rights for law enforcement family members and children that are exposed to some of these stresses that are being unaddressed. And I'd like to comment on that, please.
Eric, I'm so glad you called. Thank you very much. I think Major Conti and then maybe Todd.
Eric, thanks for that question. It's you know, you couldn't be more on point. And what I will say is it took us a long time to take care of ourselves. But in the interim of it, I think one thing I can tell you is that is happening. We are looking at the families. And right now with our peer counseling services and state police and how we interact with our colleagues statewide, we do make sure that the peer counselors are interacting with the family. In many cases, not only do we support the person, but we also support the family. And it's for all the reasons that you described. And I can tell you that you are more than just in your comments. And any law enforcement officer, first responder, cannot believe that their job hasn't affected their family in some way, shape, or form. And it is something that we're looking at, and it's something we're doing much more than we did before. And that is the part, I might add, in peer counseling that is growing the greatest right now, is the family support system. And when people get referred, how not only we refer the person that's in crisis, but we refer the family to services also.
That's a really great point, Eric. I'm so glad you called. Do you want to jump in, Todd, too? You've got a family.
I do have a family, and I'm frankly quite surprised my wife didn't divorce me. After 26 years of marriage and dealing with a mental health disorder that I have, that she stuck with me. We are healing now, but that is, Major Conte said it exactly right, is that we need to reach out to the families, because the families are the pressure relief valve for first responders, and they're also going to know about the stress that their spouse's job or their father or their mother's job is creating in their life. And so one of the things we'd like to do at Dairy Fire is to have a family day and tell my story, and then hopefully that'll open up the floodgate for people to get more help.
How do your children feel when you tell the story?
They were very pleased, and we don't hide it anymore. We don't sweep it under the rug anymore. We discuss it now. And we're still learning how to deal with it. It's only been 4 years since I got this treatment. And it's been pretty exciting to watch the transformation that has occurred. Treatment does work.
You know, Chief Goldstein, we talked earlier about suicide rates among first responders. And right at the beginning of the show, Mayor Conte told us that police are more likely to die by suicide than in the line of duty. How does police officers' access to guns as part of their daily work, how does that factor into the relatively high suicide rate that we see among police officers?
It definitely factors in because it's something that we live with. It's not just something we have. It is actually part and parcel of our daily lives. In fact, it's an extra 2 pounds that we just know that we're going to carry. About 91% of the law enforcement suicides are by gun. But again, there's that old adage in the study of suicide that says a person will suicide with a method or means they know very well. And certainly we know guns better than anybody. When we go to some of the scenes that actually Todd has made reference to and we see what a firearm can do, we know how permanent and how quick it is. So it factors in quite strongly. I would suggest that the numbers are, you know, at best guess, and that's just it. It's a good clinical estimate. But we're looking at anything from a 1-to-1 ratio from line of duty death to suicide. So if we're losing a police officer in the line of duty death every 53 hours in this country, we're looking at least one suicide, or a 3-to-1 ratio, again, depending on reporting and definitional issues as well. But the firearms are definitely a very large component.
Dr. Sawyer, what do you think about our caller who wanted to know about family members? You know, we talked earlier about the impact on the individual. Eric talked very eloquently, as did Todd and Major Conte, about help for families. But we also talked earlier about workforce shortages. So an officer may say, yes, I need help. The family may say, yes, please give us help. But are there mental health professionals like yourself out there to help them?
You know, the mental health system in general, as is no secret to anybody here, that is maxed out. And so you're absolutely right when it comes to seeking out professionals who also feel comfortable and confident working with a population like first responders, who are a unique group. The challenge becomes even greater. So it is a difficult situation when families and the individuals need help. I mean, that's just exponentially more therapists needed out there. But I think one of the most important points that can be made about this, and, you know, talking about suicide is, you know, is incredibly important, and it's certainly a hot topic in this population. But I really want to make clear that, you know, when we gotten to the point where that is the concern, then we probably should have been in treatment many years ago. And I really would strongly encourage folks out there serving in these professions and their family members, you know, getting help when you're just starting to feel like, you know, maybe this job's taking a toll on me. That's when it's time to take that step. More often than not, I'm seeing folks for the first time doing my interview with them, and our conversation goes something like, well, I've had your number for about 3 years.
Really? Wow.
And now I finally made the call. And why did they finally make the call? Well, typically it's because either their job is on the line or their marriage is almost over. And those are the two major factors that get somebody to finally go through the door. But they needed to be there a long time ago. We don't need to get to critical mass before we reach out for help.
Well, and speaking of critical mass, I gave out that suicide prevention hotline again. It's 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-TALK. And we have more information on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Dr. Sawyer, you work, as we've been hearing, not just with law enforcement, firefighters, EMTs, also with combat veterans. What's rewarding about this work for you?
Oh, well, what isn't? I mean, these folks are the people on the front lines of our communities. They're protecting us. They're taking care of us. I mean, you know, some folks will roll their eyes and say that's cliche, but the reality is these are the individuals who step up to take care of us on a daily basis. They don't do it for the big bucks. We shouldn't certainly know that. They do it because they love human beings. And I think that that's one of the most tragic things when people come into my office is when somebody is in law enforcement or fire, EMS, even serving their country, and they realize, you know what, I don't really like people anymore. I don't even like people anymore. You know, that if that's not a sign of compassion fatigue, if that's not a sign of cumulative trauma, I don't know what is. And I think the most rewarding thing for me is helping that person feel human again and allowing them to connect with humans again.
Major Conti, what would you say to a first responder listening right now who is thinking, okay, maybe I need to get some help?
So the first thing I'd like to say, you're in an honorable profession and you have colleagues that care. And we are in a place now better than we've ever been. So seek that help. Talk to somebody. There is services that you can access. And you will have a better career. You will be a better leader in your career, and you'll be a better father and a better wife and a better family member. But just to go, we are at a different place. And for me to come through a long career and to be able to be where I am now, giving back, is a shining example of that. And the one other thing I'll say is, as you go through your career, remember that, you know, that this is something we all chose to do, and it's something that we'll continue to do. And even there is a life after, also.
All right. It's been really good to talk to all of you. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.